Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the July 2025 issue. First up is a piece of fiction titled A Dog in a Thunderstorm by C. Mallon. In the eighth grade, I hit a kid named Kevin Flowers so hard in the face that he had to travel out of state to get a corrective rhinoplasty. He made a horrible joke. He hadn't even been talking to me. He didn't know any better. He only did it where I could hear him. Kevin was sat behind me in the cafeteria talking to his friends. He was saying these terrible things. They were laughing. He didn't really do anything wrong, but it got in my brain like a hot needle. Punched through the leather. I could feel all the red pressure of that make some big evil fist in the back of my eyes, how you'd feel the rot heat of a sinus infection. My shoulders had cramped up so tight that my body was shaking. I figured I had to wreck something to get it out of myself. I figured he didn't know any better, but I didn't care at all. I got up and wrapped my hand all in the thin, greasy hair on the top of his scalp, wrenched his head back, and hit him in the face so hard I split my pointer knuckle open on his canine. People were shrieking. I pulled him backward off the red plastic bench he was sat on and threw him down. He had a carton of apple juice there in his hand. His fingers clamped hard down around it from the shock of being hit, and it sprayed out sweet and yellow all over his cotton shirt. He didn't ever try to hit me back. I knelt on his chest, and I hit him twice in the center of his face, arm drawn back how you'd go up to bat in a baseball game, forced the impact just shattering up through my shoulder, pure recoil. I fractured his eye socket. His nose was totally destroyed. I gave him a serious concussion. I split his upper lip, punched back so hard on his front teeth it cut apart right to the gum line. He looked like he had a cleft lip. He looked majorly deformed. It took this big, heavy, learning disabled kid who'd gotten held back a couple of times to pull me off his body and pin me down until I quit trying to get up and hit him again. I wasn't sure about a lot of what happened once I had come back to myself, but I knew that I'd been screaming in his face, all my hair hanging down on him, quick flecks of drool and limp threads of clear spit, how hot oil comes off hot meat while it's frying. I was screaming down onto him, "Is it funny to you? Do you think it's funny? Do you think it's funny?" He was bleeding so badly. People were bringing him fistfuls of cheap paper napkins to wad up right under his nose. He was totally hysterical. He had pissed his pants while I was beating on him. He was skittering backward on the linoleum with his wet sneakers tacky and dragging on his own blood. Wet blue jeans soaked dark and stuck to his weak legs, crying really hard. He was trembling, desperate. He couldn't get his body to quit. He looked how a dog in a thunderstorm would. He put his wrists up like Christ, held right out in front of him. Blood red as ordinary paint, dripped thick and drying in the crazed lines of his hands, and then he passed out with his back up on the concrete support pillar set in the center of the room. They'd painted the whole cafeteria this pastel color of pink. It looked like a kid hospital. I felt really unwell. Kevin had a girlfriend, Laura Lee. She had a thick, greasy face the color of a rising moon. She had horrible pimples. They looked like they had to be hurting her. I didn't figure anybody ever thought about that. How what makes you ugly makes you hurt. She had her thick little hands clamped, crab-clawed on the fine branching bones of his shoulder, agitating his slack body and dragging him into her lap, sat cross-legged and stained on the wet floor, and she was saying, "You killed him, Hal. You killed him." I didn't know what to do with the blood on my knuckles. I'd cut up my hand on his face. I wiped it up into my hair. I was feeling really fraught and demented. I didn't feel like so much of a person. By the time that I was hauled up and out of the room and I saw him there, wet with the piss, blood, and apple juice, I understood that I'd done a really terrible thing. I couldn't quit looking at him. I wanted to tell him that I was sorry, but I couldn't do it. There wasn't a right thing to do anymore. It had happened already. There wasn't any way of walking it back. I could have gone to juvenile detention if Kevin's parents hadn't been so strange about it all. It was a really sad situation. Nobody liked Kevin. He was little and mean. He had gotten in fights before, and he'd gotten his ass beat before, and it had been his fault. He'd gotten detention before, and he'd gotten suspended before. What happened to him really wasn't his fault, and it wasn't deserved. He hadn't earned it. He hadn't been asking for it. He hadn't done anything wrong. Nobody thought about that. I hadn't ever hit somebody. I hadn't ever got very upset, taken something so hard that I had to destroy and to detonate that way before. I didn't get in any serious trouble. Nobody tried to hold me criminally responsible. Kevin's parents pulled him out of school for 6 months, and then they sent him to the Catholic high school a county over for the following year. My parents offered to pay Kevin's medical bills. My parents were called in to meet with the faculty. They asked me what Kevin had said to get me so mad. I told them I couldn't remember. I figured they'd push me around on that, but they didn't. And for a really long time, it was true. I had a blank shape where Kevin ought to have rightfully been. Nobody got to shouting. I didn't look anybody in the eye. They let me go to the bathroom. I put my hands underneath the hot water and spoke to myself, quiet, watching myself in the mirror until my face started to come apart. You killed him, Hal. You killed him. It really bothered me whenever I would think about it hard. I tried to play it again. I tried to play it back like it was only a videotape, but there wasn't a sound or a picture there for it. I had it in colors. I didn't know what he'd said. I figured it must have been bad, and I put it away. I quit thinking about it. On the long drive home, my mom and dad had a stiffness to their bodies in the front seat that I mostly hadn't seen before. Packed glitter ice on the road. It was snowing. Nobody spoke. I must have felt like a yellow wasp shut in the car with them. I must have felt like a devil dog. I wasn't troubled by that. I wanted them to look at me, know me the way that I was. Cold the blood now, and changed. Going to bed that night, I was so cut up and sick about all of it that I couldn't get to sleep. Long hours turning my body around, sweating, wispy baby hair soaked to my forehead, damp of my shirt stuck flak onto my slick back. I got up out of the bed, and I crept through the drowsing house, shedding my wet shirt, my bed pillow under my arm, and I locked myself into the bathroom. I slept in the bathtub with all the lights on, my left hand a navy blue thundercloud, weeping clean plasma and cradled to my chest the way that you'd hold a stuffed animal. I got a week of suspension, and for a long time I forgot about Kevin. Mandated counseling sessions 2 times a week. His name was Benjamin. He wasn't a real therapist. He had a bachelor's degree in psychology from the state college. He said if I ever felt like doing something like that to anybody again, then I ought to try to take some deep breaths. Benjamin gave me a smooth pink stone out of a drawer in his battered desk. He said to hold it real tight in my fist anytime I was feeling afraid or upset. He really liked crystals. He really liked rocks. I carried that stone around in my chest pocket with my quarters and my peppermints, sometimes a crushed half pack of Newport menthol cigarettes. I slept with it tight in my hand. I guess Cody John saw me hit Kevin in the cafeteria. His father was a wrestling coach over at the high school. Cody John didn't hardly know me at all, though I guess we had gone to the same birthday parties in kindergarten. He had no reason to think I was anything other than bad. He had no reason to want me around, but I guess that he talked to his father about it. His dad came around to my parents' house one afternoon, not long after I hit Kevin Flowers. He asked my mom if I might maybe want to try wrestling. He said he thought it'd help me to get some aggression out. I didn't want to get any aggression out. But I knew Cody John wrestled, and I figured Cody John's dad came off as a decent type of man. He didn't freak me out. He didn't kick me around. I started going by the high school. Cody John was always glad to see me, which I couldn't ever really understand. We'd sit on the wood bleachers watching the varsity team hit each other and struggle. Cody John's dad always drove me home after, even though it wasn't on his way to anywhere. And me and Cody John would sit in the back of that car, me on the left side and him on the right, how he did in Dylan's car, even though he could have sat up front with his dad if he'd wanted to. And pretty often, Cody John's dad would buy me a soda at the gas station or fries and a milkshake at the drive-thru, the same way that he would for Cody John. I tried to give him $20 one time because he took me and Cody John to the Dairy Queen. I got a Dilly Bar, and Cody John got a Blizzard with hot fudge and Butterfingers. He had to hold it with both of his hands. Cody John's dad got a chocolate malt, and when I tried to press the crumpled cotton bill into his tough, chapped hand, he said, "Come on, Hal," and he laughed, and he wouldn't take it from me. That made my chest hurt. I was so hurt that he'd laughed. I was so torn up about it. It really bothered me. Next time I saw him, I told him to fuck off when he tried to put his hands on me at practice. He'd put his hands on the other boys to get them into position. I got up off of the mat, and I walked out. I stood all alone in the locker room. I wasn't sure what to do with my body. I couldn't quit twitching. I couldn't quiet myself down. I put my shirt and my blue jeans on over my singlet and wet my hair under the faucet. I put my wrestling boots in the trash. I sat out on the dark parking lot, shivering, until the practice was over. I wasn't feeling so much of anything. I'd left my sweatshirt, my jacket, and sneakers inside of the gym. Cody John found me there, out on the lot, in my socks, with my knuckles blue-pink and my mouth blue. He got the keys to the truck from his dad, and he got it started, hit the heat high, wrapped me all up in a fleece hunting blanket he found in the back seat, and sat me up front by the vents. He thawed me out. What had been numb got to hurting. I kept trying to tell him that I was sorry. My jaw was locked stiff. He was talking to me all the time. He didn't seem fucked up about the way that I was. Cody John told me to wait in the truck. I hadn't ever been so tired before. He got my wrestling boots from the garbage can. I'd figured Cody John's dad would be ugly to me about it, but he wasn't that. We didn't talk about what happened. I fell asleep in the passenger seat while he drove me home. When Cody John's dad pulled up on the drive, when he said, "Wake up, Hal, buddy, we're here," I felt just like a little kid. I wanted somebody to carry me. I wanted somebody to put me to bed. I said goodnight to them both, and I went in the house. Cody John's dad didn't ever get mad when I got mad. He didn't put his hands on me again. He was a good man. He gave me a whole lot of grace. By the time I started at the high school, I had a lot of pretty good acquaintances. I knew all the wrestlers already, and they were decent to me, and nobody bothered me, and nobody tried to push me around. I didn't think about Kevin at all, not for a long time. Not until I heard about what had happened with Lori Lee. She got too drunk at a house party, winter break sophomore year, and she tried to walk home by herself. They found her a street south of her own house in the dull suburb she lived in. All the houses looked the same. When her keys wouldn't work in the door, she lay down in a snowbank. She wasn't wearing her jacket. She'd left it back at the party. They found her, blue and undamaged, there, grit and salt knotted in her stiff hair. They had to chisel her off the packed ice. She was 15. I knew that I'd really scared her with Kevin. I had made one of her days bad. I couldn't forgive myself for it. I got to thinking about what had happened a lot. We had a mandatory meeting in the high school gym the first day back at school. The microphone kept feeding back in a negative loop. Everybody bored on the bleachers. Some of the girls cried. Afterward, I got a cheeseburger with Cody John. We were headed back around to the high school in my mother's car when I remembered what Kevin had said in the cafeteria. I put it all together really fast. I pulled the car over, stalled out on the gravel shoulder, and I put the parking brake on. I said, "Cody, could you drive maybe?" And he said, "Sure, Hal, for sure." Pale concern plain in his voice. I got out of the car and I threw up on the road, wet from the snowmelt, streaked slick with bright, grimy rainbows of oil, ground beef and pickles. Cody John got me up. He fed me slow sips of his soda. He got in the driver's side door and he got the car started. I lay my cheek on the door plastic, gripping my wrist tight until it was wax white and bloodless. Cody drove it with the windows down, clean smell of pine and cold water. I didn't talk about it. I was late to fifth period chemistry. I didn't want for anybody to see it. I had come to understand that if I didn't feel anything on the outside, then it couldn't do me any damage in my body. I knew that it set me apart. I knew that it made me too different. I knew that if I said it out loud, nobody would look me in the eye ever again. I knew that everybody thought I was strange. I figured that they didn't want to know why. I hadn't wanted to know why. Probably not ever. I hadn't wanted a reason. I wanted power and muscle and teeth. All of the wrestling made me tall somehow. Scaffolding of my weird, jointed, stiff body rebuilt. Reconfigured in some way that made it strong, whole, long and tough, broad and built out of gristle and wire and iron. Fat wrapped around it to make me look like a regular man, but I wasn't that. I had gone wrong somewhere. There was no fixing that. There was no turning away from it, wore it under my shirt. Caught in the wrong type of light, you could see it glitch, dark halo, frail splinter hologram. I didn't like to look anybody in the face for too long. How I hated to see it there. I was afraid that I'd see it there. Somewhere, I was always afraid. C. Mallon's first novel, Dogs, from which this extract is taken, will be published next month by Scribner. Next up, Dan Pippenbring reviews some new books. Worms love southwestern Ontario. The region's dairy farms offer loamy soil, untilled, and laden with manure, an annelid's Arcadia. On damp nights, when the wind dies down and the temperature is just so, the fields fairly writhe with the pale, glistening constituents of Lumbricus terrestris, surfacing from the depths to feed and mate. This image alone, the ground seething with plump masses dancing their peristaltic dance, belongs in a David Cronenberg movie, but it gets worse, or better, because there are people out there too, worm pickers, sometimes hundreds of them, stooping to collect their quarry. Beams from their headlamps skitter over the land, glazing everything in sinister reds and oranges. White light spooks the worms. They work until dawn. You can fit about 300 worms in a jumbo-sized tin can. On a good night, the best pickers harvest 20,000. The worms are soon packed and stacked in styrofoam flats, stored in refrigerated warehouses, and shipped off to gas stations and Bass Pro Shops and Walmarts across North America. They end up impaled on fish hooks in one body of water or another. This is the world of Joshua Steckley's The Nightcrawlers, a story of worms, cows, and cash in the underground bait industry. University of California Press, 29.95. Drawn though I am to the slight, the mere, the vanishingly specific, I wasn't prepared for this degree of minutiae. I'm not sure if grains come any finer. Even Steckley's interviewees doubted the necessity of such a project. "A book about worm picking," one of them laughed. "Good luck with that." But I'm glad he's written about this extraordinary oddity in our consumer culture. Someone had to. Steckley, who holds a PhD in geography, grew up in Worm Country and never forgot how the Pickers lamplight cut through the night. Eventually, he got to wondering, why is there only one worm capital of the world, and why is it based around Toronto? Why are most worm pickers Vietnamese immigrants? What needs to happen to turn the nightcrawler, the same banal creature found in gardens and on flooded sidewalks across the continent, into a valuable commodity? And what might this tell us about the relationship between capitalism and nature? Steckley gets to the bottom of it. Despite the fact that the worm trade is almost literally fly by night, and its prime movers would like to keep it that way, access to premium sites can become competitive to the point of violence. A lot of cash trades hands. The taxman doesn't always get his cut. The business coalesced in the prosperous post-war era, when the expanding middle classes found that they enjoyed fishing on the weekends. Nightcrawlers caught fish, so people caught nightcrawlers. Golf courses at first were reliable hunting grounds, and bait companies rewarded them handsomely for exclusive picking rights. From the 50s through the 80s, America's fairways teemed at irregular hours with retirees, college students, and enterprising children, one journalist wrote, pinching worms from the shorn lawns and dropping them in cans strapped around their ankles. But in time, Ontario emerged as the preeminent worm hub. It had quality dirt and, thanks to successive waves of immigration, cheap labor. Steckley spoke to one man whose family picked him up from the airport and drove him straight to a golf course from his first night of work. By the 70s, the major players in the worm exchange were congregating at the Sinistri Cafe, a Greek restaurant in Toronto. In the morning, over demi-tasses and backgammon, buyers and sellers negotiated the day's wholesale price as truckloads of worms waited outside. There was copious swearing. Things haven't evolved much since then. The industry's last great innovation was to rent pastures from farmers. Some refuse to let worm pickers on their property because they think removing the worms degrades their soil, while a number of the farmers who do allow pickers swear to Steckley that it improves theirs. Climate change has made ideal worm weather harder to come by, but attempts to cultivate worms en masse or trap them have failed. Nightcrawlers refuse to be scaled or automated. The only way to get them is to bend over and pick them up. Tens of thousands of Vietnamese refugees settled in Toronto in the 80s, and word spread among them that worm picking was a sure way to make money, albeit a punishing one. Pickers ruined their knees and backs over years of creeping through the squirming acres. If you are coming from a civil war, one subject tells Steckley, you can do a lot of things. Most of them are now in their 50s or 60s. The years have made them fleet-fingered, light on their feet, and constantly sore. They're paid in piece rates, $18 Canadian or thereabouts per 1,000 worms. That's a notable decrease from the roughly $40 per 1,000 worms, adjusted for inflation, that pickers received in the 50s. Today's pickers know they're working a job that no one wants, and that the younger generation is unlikely to replace them. They are undeterred. Some of them picture the worms as coins scattered on the ground. I just think I'm picking one cent, money. But you have to hoover up the worms to rake in the pennies. Steckley volunteered for a shift and captured about 300 worms from their burrows and middens. His labor would have netted him less than $7, exactly 23 cents per worm. It takes time to learn to use one's hand as a tool. When I could get a decent grip, he writes, the worm would come out with the sound and satisfaction of uprooting a weed. Other worms could hold to the soil so tightly that I would tear their bodies in half. He took regular breaks. Everyone does. Farmers, after a night of picking, find their fields strewn with detritus, adult diapers, cigarette butts, snack bags, sawdust essential for drying one's fingers between bouts with slimy worms, and, in at least one instance, a condom. Steckley has stumbled into a world almost designed to be overlooked. At a Tim Hortons, where else in Canada is there, he meets the Worm Queen, a Vietnamese woman in her late 30s, known for her ability to clear 30,000 worms in a night. The worms started to infiltrate her dreams, he writes, but she cherished the job for its freedom. Pickers, to Steckley's astonishment, often use that word to describe their work. They go at their own pace, with no supervision, no need to explain themselves to anyone. Nobody controls you, another picker tells him. Nobody tells you what to do. By this narrow definition, Maurice and Marilyn Bailey were as free as two worm pickers when they spent 4 months adrift on a life raft in the Pacific Ocean. Nobody controlled them, and nobody told them what to do. Sophie Elmhurst's A Marriage at Sea, a true story of love, obsession, and shipwreck, Riverhead Books, $28, tells the story of the couple's 1973 catastrophe, focusing on the sustaining connection between them. It's billed as a love story. I don't know if it is. Whatever held the Baileys together, whatever kept them alive, was stranger and plainer than love, harder to come by, and even harder to explain. Maurice and Marilyn came from a suburb of Derby, England, a place so confining, a particular kind of quiet stiffened the air, Elmhurst writes, that they decided that life on a 31-foot yacht would be less claustrophobic. They sold their house to buy the Orlin, built somewhat ominously by a company known for its coffins. In June 1972, they set sail for New Zealand, intending to spend about 15 months crossing two oceans. They brought 500 cans of food, but no radio, to preserve their freedom from outside interference. Marilyn embarked on the journey, having never learned to swim. 9 months of starlight and sea air, chess, books, sewing, the sextant, and the nautical almanac. Bibulous pit stops and scenic ports ended abruptly one March morning when a sperm whale smashed a hole in their boat. The water was soon at their knees. Eggs and tins bobbed around them, Elmhurst writes, with characteristic understatement. They looked at each other. Within minutes, they retreated to the life raft, 4.5 feet in diameter, too small for two people to lie in side by side, and lashed it to the yacht's dinghy, rescuing what supplies they could. Their bodies felt the insecurity of every wave. Maurice, hamstrung by doubt in the best of times, perceived the accident as evidence of his highly unseaman-like failure and wallowed in it. His captaincy had given him purpose, discipline, virtue. Now he was certain they would die. This certainty made him useless. It was Marilyn who supplied the will to live, easily mistakable for, and perhaps identical to, a capacity for self-deception. She undertook practical tasks with a Panglossian zeal, intuiting that doing limited the dangers of thinking, as Elmhurst writes. Marilyn inventoried the remaining comestibles, steak and kidney pudding, marmalade, treacle, all to be washed down with rainwater. She forced Maurice into distraction, reading aloud to him. Their biography of Richard III remained gloriously intact, and fashioning a deck of playing cards out of spare paper. As their flesh ulcerated and their stinking clothes rotted off their bodies, they enjoyed hours of delirious whist under the unrelenting sun. Accosted by a flotilla of turtles, she suggested killing one and eating it, thereby discovering a replenishable source of protein. Later, they caught two and hitched them to the dinghy, hoping the turtles would swim them toward the Galapagos. When their charioteers proved uncooperated, they killed and ate them. Disaster stories have an easy grip on the lurid imagination, but it can be tough to find the drama in 118 shipwreck days. There's monotony even on the brink of death if you stay there long enough. The Bailey's own memoir about the ordeal was so matter-of-fact that it read like a dual account of an unremarkable holiday that took a slightly unconventional turn, Elmhurst writes. But she herself has an admirably light touch. Her short sentences contain something of the Bailey's emotionlessness, their desolation, silence, and the slow putrefaction of their faculties. Her eye for detail also brings alive the surreal sensory fusillade of the couple's improbable rescue by the Wolmi 306, a South Korean fishing ship, and the celebrity that followed in its wake, photo ops, game show appearances, a filmed visit to SeaWorld. The Avon Rubber Company, manufacturers of the dinghy and the life raft, invited them to open its new factory, Llanelli, South Wales. The Baileys were there with bells on. They were a hot commodity, not because they'd lived, but because they hadn't died. You are listening to readings from the July 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Absurdly, they did it again. They got back out there on another yacht, the Orlan II, and successfully navigated a 14-month journey to Patagonia, this time with some friends aboard. Elmhurst mostly skips this part, except to note that it was an insane thing to do, and that Maurice was especially tyrannical on his second go as captain. And yet I badly wanted to know how their marriage fared in those years and the ones beyond. I wanted to know what held them fast to each other, if not some entwined PTSD, and I wanted to know what Maurice, with his fixation on emotional self-sufficiency, made of England in the Thatcher years, when he may finally have felt at home there. Throughout A Marriage at Sea, Elmhurst occasionally lands on a knowing question. After all, what is more self-interested than running away? For what else is a marriage, really, if not being stuck on a small raft with someone and trying to survive? Where I would have gone for an expression of genuine ignorance, because I am ignorant. I don't understand. The Baileys stuck to the surface, at least, on their quest for autonomy. The loners and pariahs in submersed wonder, obsession, and murder in the world of amateur submarines, Pantheon, $28, insist on sinking. This is Matthew Gavin Frank's look at personal, submersible enthusiasts, men and one woman, who find freedom by diving in homemade submarines, building an artificial womb and enclosing oneself in it, at organ-smushing pressures can offer an innocuous escape. Often I'll just sit on the bottom of the lake and watch the fish go by, one hobbyist says, and eat my lunch. Or it can provide an outlet for one's most megalomaniacal impulses. Peter Madsen, the Danish designer of the UC3 Nautilus, boasted that his submarine could make him virtually government uncontrollable. He's currently serving a life sentence for killing and dismembering a Swedish journalist, Kim Wall, aboard his sub in 2017. If you read the portion of Submersed that appeared in the pages of this magazine 2 years ago, you may expect a book charged with awe and bioluminescent wonder. In fact, it's a much darker affair, dominated by Madsen and his Bond villain pathologies. Frank can't help but see a link between deep-sea confinement and violence. The men he speaks with are always talking about how sexy parts of their submarines are, their impressive size, etc. Submariners on the USS Florida, only the second sub to have female officers aboard in U.S. naval history, made a rape list in 2018, he notes. One guy tells him outright that the biggest genius is Hitler. Frank is an unrepentant maximalist, a lover of wide scope and picayune detail. He gives us Alexander the Great in his bathysphere, Jules Verne squabbling with the editor of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He informs us that Wall shared a birthday with both Chaka Khan and the inventor of liquid paper. the journalist's final wave goodbye to her loved ones occasions a 3-page history of waving. The wave has been called by the American Psychological Association one of the more essential components of human language. It's a lot, but Frank has to compensate for his subjects' acute dispassion. Many of them see nothing unusual or profound in their yen to hide under the sea. It is a fascinating hobby, one writes on an online forum for enthusiasts, as long as everything works out. And if it doesn't? Submersed addresses, as it must, the tragedy of OceanGate's submersible Titan, which imploded in 2023 while surveying the wreck of the Titanic, killing all 5 aboard. A British billionaire, one of Pakistan's wealthiest businessmen, and his teenage son, a veteran explorer nicknamed Mr. Titanic, and OceanGate's heedless CEO. That CEO, one of Frank's sources suggests, had a suicidal streak. He referred to his diving addiction as the deep disease, and he may have known that his craft would fail. I was surprised that Frank, for all his digressive energies, didn't engage with the outpouring of memes that followed the Titan's demise. Beneath the Pasquinade was the desire to implode. Above ground, someone slapped the Titan's image on baggies of wheat. Seeing a photo of one of these, empty and discarded on the street, I wished I had found it in real life. I wanted to bend over and pick it up. Next, in the Easy Chair column, Eric Baker explores Trump's Darwinian America. The only thing everyone can agree on about why Donald Trump does what he does is that his reasons are not obvious. There are innumerable proposals on offer for an intellectual framework that supposedly unifies and explains Trump's chaos. He is Vladimir Putin's puppet, an unreconstructed disciple of Pat Buchanan thought, a loyal servant of the conservative think tanks that concocted Project 2025, or a Machiavellian mobster focused single-mindedly on self-enrichment. And yet I can't help but suspect that Trump's own explanation is closest to the mark. "I'm a very instinctual person," he told Time magazine in 2017, "but my instinct turns out to be right." One need not agree with the latter judgment to recognize that Trump's account of himself rings true. He values the irrational quality of his decisions as an end in itself. In the first months of his second reign, Trump has appealed more to his instincts than ever before. "I mean, you almost can't take a pencil to paper," he said in April, describing his approach to determining tariff exemptions. "It's really more of an instinct, I think, than anything else." This veneration of instinct has led many observers to describe Trump as a social Darwinist. This interpretation of Darwin's work, celebrating the triumph of the strong and the extermination of the weak, is a common thread uniting the otherwise ideological, disparate set of historical leaders Trump has praised, from the American empire builders of the late 19th century to, according to his former chief of staff John Kelly, Adolf Hitler. Darwin saw in animal instincts one general law leading to the advancement of all organic beings, to wit, multiply, vary, let the strongest live and the weakest die. Trump, like many among his social Darwinist predecessors, surely views the impulses he is determined to unleash in similar terms. Of all the various isms proposed to capture Trump's ideology, social Darwinism has perhaps the most explanatory power. Moreover, it is likely the only one that he, or the writing produced under his name, has explicitly endorsed. A lot of life is about survival of the fittest and adaptation, as Darwin pointed out, his 2009 book, Think Like a Champion, asserts. Since Trump's initial rise to power, the social Darwinist label has served to mark him as an aberration, someone who failed to learn the lessons that the 20th century was supposed to have taught us. On the campaign trail in 2016, Tim Kaine implied that Trump's social Darwinism animated his criticisms of NATO and the system of alliances America built after World War II. Last October, Jonathan Chait argued that the social Darwinist commitments Trump shares with the rest of the Republican Party distinguish it not only from the Democrats, but from conservative parties and other industrialized democracies. But for much of the 20th century, American liberals had trouble admitting that there even were social Darwinists anymore. In Social Darwinism in American Thought, the 1944 book that popularized the term, Richard Hofstadter writes that the ideology, at least as a conscious philosophy, had largely disappeared in the United States by the end of World War I, thanks to its uncomfortably Teutonic overtones. Reasoning along similar lines, the historian Carl N. Deckler asserted in 1991 that the struggle against Nazism had at last left social Darwinism definitely killed, not merely scotched. But ideas that are truly dead rarely return to life so swiftly and with such vitality. What we're witnessing is not an aberration, but the latest eruption of a supposedly discredited ideology that was never truly extinguished. Even after the Holocaust, social Darwinism quietly remained a meeting ground where defenders of class, race, and gender hierarchy could make common cause. What historians such as Hofstadter and Deckler mistook for its depth was merely its tactical retreat and metamorphosis. To understand how this happened, we must reconsider what we thought we knew about the world America built in the aftermath of its war against fascism. We must contrast our romanticized view of liberal, democratic values with Trump's blunt characterization of American society. It's a cruel world, and people are ruthless. Social Darwinism first came of age at a moment when the usefulness of liberalism to the development of capitalism seemed exhausted. While for much of the 19th century, the idea of universal rights had helped empower the middle classes, by the century's waning decades, political and economic elites increasingly viewed egalitarianism as a spur to troublesome radical democratic movements and an obstacle to the brutality on which the era's imperialist expansion depended. Social Darwinism, on the other hand, placed an emphasis on immutable difference that cut a pleasing contrast to liberal universalism and its attendant ideological risks. It proposed strength, rather than self-restraint, as the mark of distinction. Biology made the rich, the white, and the male superior, and endowed them with the right to dominate their inferiors. After World War II, when the United States' embrace of the anti-fascist struggle raised the possibility that its own apartheid system would be the next target, a vanguard of white nationalists and Nazi sympathizers rallied around a private philanthropy called the Pioneer Fund, which had been established shortly before the war. The fund's grants helped ensure that scientists who shared the founders' enthusiasm for the Third Reich's selective breeding policies could pursue their work under an all-American aegis. As the civil rights movement gained momentum, prominent Pioneer Fund-backed race scientists such as Arthur Jensen and the Nobel Prize-winning physicist William Shockley grabbed headlines for announcing that their research proved that the genetic determination of intelligence placed firm biological limits on the project to redress racial inequality. At the same time, a more demure set of scientists was quietly laying the foundation for the renovation of social Darwinism in mainstream biological thinking. The 1973 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine went to three scientists, including Konrad Lorenz, an Austrian biologist and former Nazi Party member who helped found the field of ethology, the scientific study of animal behavior, which he believed ought to encompass humans as well. Though Lorenz eventually distanced himself from his past, he remained concerned about the risk of degeneration produced by modern interference with the process of natural selection, a central theme of his Nazi-era work that he continued to express for the rest of his career, albeit with less ominous language. This was a fear shared with all its eugenicist implications by W.D. Hamilton, one of the most influential evolutionary biologists of the second half of the 20th century. Hamilton helped develop new theoretical tools that allowed scientists to postulate a genetic basis for a range of complex social behaviors. Among these behaviors, in Hamilton's view, was genocide, which was a natural, if morally regrettable, response to population growth among a competing tribe. In the 70s, the evolutionary biological approach to the study of human behavior grew even more popular. Its leading exponents were Hamilton's Oxford colleague, Richard Dawkins, who has called Hamilton the greatest Darwinian of my lifetime, and the Harvard entomologist E.O. Wilson, who recalled his imagination being captured by Lorenz at a pivotal point in his graduate studies. Dawkins' 1976 bestseller, The Selfish Gene, and Wilson's field-defining 1975 book, Sociobiology, proposed that nearly any feature of human society could be explained in terms of its propensity to propagate the genes responsible for it. Race never looked too far below the surface of the polemics that ensued, but amid the rise of second-wave feminism and the gay liberation movement, the champions of sociobiology and its successor field, evolutionary psychology, focused more and more on arguing that differences between men and women were, in fact, rooted in biology, not just social conditioning. Enter the libertarians and neoliberals. For the late 20th century intellectuals who sought to show, like Margaret Thatcher, that there was no alternative to the free market, sociobiological explanations of human behavior provided scientific-sounding justification for their economic policies. In an early response to Wilson's Sociobiology, the Nobel-winning Chicago School economist Gary Becker affirmed that the preferences taken as given by economists, such as self-interest, altruism toward kin, social distinction, and other enduring aspects of human behavior, could be largely explained by the selection over time of traits having greater genetic fitness and survival value. The neoliberal economist Gordon Tullock shared his admiration for Wilson's excellent book. Tullock's own foray into bioeconomic theory, The Economics of Non-Human Societies, argued that economic modeling could help explain how non-human animals like ants manage complex social coordination without central planning. Social insects and other social species normally only have an economy, but no government, Tullock wrote. Humans think that government is a necessary precondition for the function of the economy. Thus, this proposition may seem bizarre. This was precisely the premise that the most radical neoliberals sought to use sociobiology to question. As the historian Quinn Slobodian writes in his recent book, Hayek's Bastards, this neoliberal and libertarian admiration for social Darwinism often extended to ideas about immutable biological differences between the rich and the poor, between men and women, and among races. The economist Friedrich Hayek himself was skeptical about how much genetics could explain human behavior, but he drew explicit analogies between biological evolution and the development of the capitalist marketplace. Many of his followers were more vocal about the role of biology in determining economic outcomes. Slobodian places special emphasis on people like Charles Murray and right-wing think tank stalwarts such as the market fundamentalist Murray Rothbard. In a glowing review of The Bell Curve, Murray's widely denounced book, co-written with Richard Herrnstein, claiming that IQ determines success and varies by race, Rothbard wrote that the author's willingness to tell the truth about race and IQ furnished libertarians with a powerful defense of the results of the free market. By supposing to disprove the idea that racial inequality originated in discrimination, racialist science served for Rothbard as an operation in defense of private property against assaults by aggressors. But Rothbard got the rhetorical order of operations backward. By supporting free market ideas, which even many liberals embraced during the Clinton era, people unintentionally provided cover for those promoting more extreme beliefs about biological inequality. As neoliberalism colonized American common sense, it brought social Darwinist thinking along with it, rebranding ideas once thought discredited as markers of sober rationality and open-mindedness. In a 2013 lecture, the social psychologist and soi-disant centrist Jonathan Haidt railed against the tendency of both sides to deny inconvenient truths. The right included evolution deniers and climate change deniers, Haidt explained, while the left featured IQ deniers, heritability deniers, and stereotype accuracy deniers, such that they deserve the label of evolution deniers themselves. Haidt is far from the first person to assert that a proper understanding of evolutionary science implies the existence of heritable group differences, including in intelligence, that conform to common stereotypes. This notion has not, however, usually served as a hallmark of political moderation. While Slobodian is correct to call these neoliberal social Darwinists Hayek's bastards, one might think of them instead as a different early 20th century Austrian's offspring, reticent and a tad embarrassed about their parentage. Donald Trump is certainly not a heritability denier. "We got a lot of bad genes in our country right now," he remarked in a television interview last October. But Trump has probably never read Jonathan Haidt, or Murray Rothbard, or Charles Murray, or anything for that matter, besides The Power of Positive Thinking, and perhaps his ghostwriter's drafts of his books. He comes by his social Darwinism the way most people come by any ideology, by living in a world that makes it seem obvious. After World War II, the United States promised to reestablish the global order on the foundations of liberalism. Trump, born in 1946, has spent his entire life observing that order unmasking itself as the old imperial abattoir reborn. In the ashes of Korea, the killing fields of Indonesia, the burning jungles of Vietnam, the torture camps of the War on Terror, and the bloody rubble of Gaza, he has seen the United States dismember its own welfare state, outsource its social services to the highest bidders, and accumulate the largest populations of homeless and incarcerated people in the developed world. The rate of union membership in America has declined by roughly two-thirds in his lifetime. He has witnessed the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment and the calcification of the racial wealth gap. Each year he stands by, as we all do, as tens of thousands of people die because they can't afford life-saving health care. While this history was unfolding, many Americans imagined themselves to be watching a remarkable story of progress, the moral arc of the universe bending toward justice. The United States defeated fascism and finally reckoned with its own legacy of segregation. It outlasted the Soviet Union and harnessed the power of the market to cure disease and connect the world. Now we can look back and see the festering presence of social Darwinism lurking throughout the whole post-war era, like a monstrous Forrest Gump. The United States' enduring attachment to empire and racial domination helped ensure the survival of social Darwinist ideas, just as the imperialist expansion of the late 19th century gave the ideology its initial purchase. In turn, these ideas, repackaged and sanitized by popular psychologists and libertarian economists, eventually helped to sanctify inequality as the foundation of the neoliberal order, to create a dog-eat-dog political economy that only strengthened the appeal of social Darwinism as an explanation of how society operates. For his part, Trump, with the perverse insight with which he is blessed, was able to perceive the cruelty and ruthlessness of the America he grew up in earlier than many of his peers. He concluded at a young age that reason and principle are deceptions, that there are only power and domination and instinct. Now he is far from alone. It will continue to prove impossible to extirpate social Darwinism as long as the American empire refuses to part with the violence, cruelty, and exploitation that give it plausibility as a description of reality. The main reason Americans keep listening to the propagandists who inform them that some people are inherently better than others is that they live in a society whose organization and daily operation present them with that same message. "I happen to be a person that knows how life works," Trump remarked in 2017, explaining why he trusts his instincts. This is the fatalistic kernel within all instantiations of social Darwinism. Everything you see around you, all the irrationality, all the hierarchy, all the pain, is just the way of the world. The only way we can debunk this claim is to create a world that works differently. Thanks so much for joining me today for this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the July 2025 issue. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.